and mastering themselves, establish laws held in common, laid down no more for their own pleasure than for that of the defeated, and compel obedience to those laws by the two forms of constraint, reverence and fear, because they show by their strength that they are the stronger. Reverence, because they show themselves superior in mastering their own pleasures and more willing and able to be servants of the law. There is no other way for a city torn by civil strife ever to find rest from its evils. Rather, civil strife, hatred, enmity, and distrust are bound forever to arise again and again among such cities as long as they remain in that condition toward themselves. So the victors, whenever they truly desire safety, must always choose out from among themselves the best men in Greece that they can learn of first, older men, men who have wives and children at home, and as many ancestors as possible who were good and well known, and men who all possess sufficient property. For a city of 10,000 men, 50 such men are enough. These men they should summon from their own homes with entreaties and the highest honors, and once summoned and bound by oath, they should beg and instruct them to lay down laws that give no greater share to the victors than to the defeated, but equal and common rights to the whole city. And once the laws are laid down, everything depends on this. If the victors show themselves more submissive to the laws than the defeated, then everything will be full of safety and prosperity and an escape from every evil. But if not, then let no one call on me or any other partner against the man who will not obey what has now been laid down. For these things are sisters to what Dion and I once undertook together, meaning well toward Syracuse, these are the second attempt. But the first attempt was what we first tried to accomplish together with Dionysius himself, for the common good of all, until some fortune stronger than men scattered it. Now try, with better luck, to bring these very things to pass, by good fortune and some divine chance. Let this stand as my counsel and my letter, and as the account of my first visit to Dionysius. As for the later journey and voyage, how reasonably and fittingly it came about, whoever cares to hear may go on to what follows. The first period of my stay in Sicily, then, ran its course, as I said, before I gave any counsel to Dion's household and companions. After that I persuaded Dionysius, however I managed it, to let me go. When peace came, for there was war in Sicily, at the time we came to an agreement, both of us. Dionysius said he would summon Dion and me back again once he had made his rule more secure, and he asked that Dion think of what had happened not as exile, but as a change of residence. And I agreed to come back on these terms. When peace came, he summoned me, but asked that Dion wait one more year, while insisting that I come by all means. Dion, for his part, urged and begged me to sail. Indeed, a great deal of talk was coming out of Sicily to the effect that Dionysius had once again become remarkably eager for philosophy, which is why Dion pressed me so earnestly not to refuse the summons. I knew well enough how often such things happen with young men quick to learn who catch a glimpse of some worthwhile subject, yet all the same it seemed safer to me at that time to let both Dion and Dionysius go their own way. And I made enemies of them both by answering that I was an old man, and that none of what was now being done matched what had been agreed. It seems that after this Archytas went to Dionysius, before I arrived, for before I left, I had made ties of hospitality and friendship between Archytas and the people of Tarentum and Dionysius. And there were also others in Syracuse who had heard something from Dion, and others still who had picked up scraps of philosophical talk at second hand. These people, it seems, tried to discuss such matters with Dionysius themselves, as though Dionysius had heard everything I had ever thought. Now he is not by nature untalented when it comes to the power of learning, and he is remarkably eager for honor. So he was probably pleased by what was said to him, and ashamed to be seen as someone who had learned nothing while I was staying there. This made him at once long to hear things more clearly, and pushed him on further out of ambition. The reasons why he had not heard these things during my earlier stay, I explained in what I said just above. Well then, once I had gotten safely home and had refused his second invitation, as I just said, it seems that Dionysius became altogether anxious that people might think I looked down on his nature, his character, and his way of living, now that I had come to know them, and that this was why I no longer wished to visit him, as though out of distaste. I am bound to tell the truth and put up with it. If anyone, upon hearing what actually happened, should look down on my philosophy and judge that the tyrant had the better sense. Dionysius sent, for the third time, a trireme for me to make my journey easy, and he sent Archetamus, one of those who had been with Archytas and whom he supposed I valued most highly among the people in Sicily, along with other acquaintances of mine there. All of them brought me the same report, that Dionysius had made astonishing progress toward philosophy. He also sent a very long letter, knowing how I stood with Dion and how eager Dion in turn was for me to sail and come to Syracuse. The whole letter was framed from the start with all this in mind, and it said, in effect, this Dionysius to Plato. And after the customary greetings, he said nothing further before this, that if I now let myself be persuaded to come to Sicily, first of all matters concerning Dion would proceed exactly as I myself wished, and I know you will wish for what is reasonable, and I will agree to it, but if not, none of Dion's affairs, whether concerning other matters or concerning himself, would go as I would want. That is what he said. The rest would take too long to relate and is beside the point now. Other letters kept arriving too, from Archytas and the people of Tarentum, praising Dionysius's devotion to philosophy and warning that if I did not come now, I would utterly ruin the friendship they had built with Dionysius through me, a friendship of no small importance for their political affairs. Given this kind of summons at that time, with the people of Sicily and Italy pulling me one way and the people of Athens all but pushing me out with their pleading, the same argument came round again, that I must not betray Dion, nor my guest friends and companions in Tarentum. And it occurred to me that there was nothing strange in a young man, quick to learn, catching wind at second hand of matters worth discussing and being seized with a longing for the best life. I thought I ought to put this to the clear test, to see which way things really stood, and that I must on no account betray it, nor make myself the cause of so grave a reproach, if these things really had been said as reported to me. So I set out, wrapping myself in this reasoning though full of fears, and, it seems, none too happy in my forebodings. Well then, coming for the third time, I did at least accomplish this, that I made it back home safely once again by good fortune. And for this, next to God, thanks are owed to Dionysius, since when many wished to destroy me he stopped them and granted some measure of respect to my situation. When I arrived, I thought I ought first to get proof of one thing, whether Dionysius really had caught fire with philosophy, as with a flame, or whether all that talk that had reached Athens had come to nothing. Now there is a way of testing such things that is not ignoble but truly fitting for tyrants, especially tyrants surrounded by people full of second-hand chatter. And this I noticed in Dionysius as soon as I arrived, that he had been affected by it a great deal. One must show such people that the whole undertaking is possible, and through how much labor and how much toil it comes. For the one who hears it, if he is truly a philosopher, suited to the task and worthy of it, being touched by something divine, thinks he has heard of a wondrous road, one he must now strain every nerve to follow, and that life is not worth living if he does otherwise. From then on, straining himself and the one who guides him along the road, he does not let up until he has either brought everything to its end, or gained the power to guide himself without need of the one who showed him the way. Living by this resolve and according to these principles, such a man goes on, whatever business he may be engaged in, always and above all holding fast to philosophy and to that daily regimen which will make him most quick to learn, most retentive of memory, and most able to reason soberly within himself. The opposite way of life he goes on hating to the end. But those who are not truly philosophers, only tinged with opinions like men whose bodies are merely sunburnt once they see how many subjects there are to learn, how great the labor, and how disciplined and fitting the daily regimen the task demands, judge it difficult and impossible for themselves, and so prove unable even to practice it. Some of them convince themselves that they have heard enough of the whole and need no further effort at all. This, then, is the test that proves clear and safest against the self-indulgent, those incapable of hard work. The man who shows the way can never be blamed, only the pupil himself, for failing to practice everything the subject demands. In this way, then, what was said to Dionysius on that occasion was said. I did not go through everything, nor did Dionysius ask me to. He pretended he already knew many things, the most important ones, and had a sufficient grasp of them, thanks to garbled versions he had picked up from others. Later, I hear, he even wrote about what he heard then, putting it together as if it were a treatise of his own, containing nothing of what he actually heard. But of this I know nothing. I do know that certain others have written on these same matters, but who they are, they themselves do not know. This much, at any rate, I can declare about all who have written or will write claiming knowledge of the things I take seriously, whether they say they heard it from me or from others, or discovered it themselves. It is impossible, in my judgment, that they understand anything of the matter. There is no writing of mine on these subjects, nor will there ever be. For it cannot be put into words like other studies. Rather, out of long companionship with the thing itself, out of living with it, suddenly, like light kindled from a leaping flame, it is born in the soul and from then on feeds itself. And yet this much I do know. If these things were to be written or spoken, they would best be spoken by me. And if they were written badly, no one would be more pained than I if I thought they could be adequately written down and spoken for the many. What finer work could I have done in my life than to write something of great benefit to mankind and bring the nature of things into the light for all? But I do not think the attempt to speak of these matters is a good thing for men, except for those few who are able to discover the truth for themselves with a small hint. Of the rest, it would fill some with a misplaced contempt in no graceful way, and others with a lofty, empty hope, as though they had learned something solemn. Still longer thoughts about these matters have come into my mind. Perhaps what I am saying would be clearer once they are said. There is a true argument that stands against anyone who dares to write anything at all about such things, an argument I have stated often before, but it seems it must be stated now as well. For each thing that exists, there are three things through which knowledge of it must come. The knowledge itself is a fourth, and as a fifth, one must posit the thing itself, that which is knowable and truly is. First is the name, second the definition, third the image, fourth the knowledge. If you want to grasp what I am now saying, take a single example and think of all things in the same way. There is something called a circle, whose name is the very word we have just uttered. Second comes its definition, composed of nouns and verbs. That which is everywhere equidistant from its extremities to its center would be the definition of the thing that bears the names round, spherical, circle. Third is what is drawn and erased, turned on the lathe and destroyed, none of which happens to the circle itself, which all these concern, because it is other than they. Fourth is knowledge, intelligence, and true opinion about these things. And this whole must be set down as one thing again, residing not in sounds nor in bodily shapes, but in souls, by which it is clearly different both from the nature of the circle itself and from the three mentioned before. Of these, intelligence comes nearest the fifth in kinship and likeness, the others stand farther off. The same holds for straight and curved shape alike, for color, for the good and the beautiful and the just, for every body whether crafted or naturally born, fire, water, and all such things, for every living creature, for character in souls, and for all doings and sufferings. For unless a man somehow grasps the four of these, he will never be a complete partaker of knowledge of the fifth. Besides all this, these four attempt to show the quality of each thing no less than its being, because of the weakness of language. For this reason, no man of sense will ever dare to commit his thoughts to language, least of all to language that cannot be moved, which is the fate of what is written in fixed characters. But here again, you must learn what I am now saying. Every circle that is drawn in practice or turned on a lathe is full of the opposite of the fifth, for it touches the straight at every point. Whereas the circle itself, we say, contains in itself neither more nor less of the contrary nature. And we say that none of their names is fixed for any of them. Nothing prevents what are now called round things from being called straight and the straight round, and they will hold no less firmly for those who make the change and use the opposite names. The same account holds of the definition too. Since it is composed of nouns and verbs, nothing about it is fixed with sufficient firmness. And there is an endless story about each of the four, how unclear it is. But the greatest point is what we said a little earlier. There being two things, the being and the quality, when the soul seeks to know not the quality but the what, each of the four holds out to the soul, in word and in deed, the thing it is not seeking, presenting in every case what is said and shown as easily refuted by the senses, and so fills practically every man with total perplexity and confusion. Now in matters where, through bad rearing, we are not even accustomed to seek the truth, and any image put before us suffices, we do not become laughingstocks to one another. The question to the questioners, though the four could be tossed about and refuted. But wherever we compel a man to answer and reveal the fifth, anyone who wishes and is able to overturn him prevails, and makes the man expounding, whether in speeches or writings or answers, appear to most of his hearers to know nothing of what he undertakes to write or say. The audience sometimes unaware that it is not the soul of the writer or speaker being refuted, but the nature of each of the four, which is flawed by birth. Only the movement through all of them, passing up and down to each in turn, barely begets knowledge of a well-natured thing in a well-natured man. But if a man's nature is bad, and such is the condition of most souls with regard to learning and to what are called morals, or if it has been corrupted, not even Lincius could make such men see. In a word, neither quickness of learning nor memory will ever give the power to one who has no kinship with the subject, for it does not take root at all in alien natures. So those who have no natural affinity and kinship with the just and with everything else that is beautiful, even if they learn quickly and remember other things well, and likewise those who have the kinship but learn slowly and forget, none of these will ever learn the truth of virtue to the extent possible, nor of vice. For these must be learned together, and the false and the true of the whole of being together, through all that rubbing and long time I spoke of at the beginning. Only when each of them, names and definitions, sights and perceptions, is rubbed hard against the others, tested in kindly refutations, using question and answer without envy, does understanding of each blaze out, and intelligence, straining to the very limit of human power. Therefore, every serious man will beware of ever writing about the things that are serious, and casting them among men into envy and confusion. From this, in one word, one must recognize. Whenever one sees a man's written compositions, whether the laws of a lawgiver or writings of any other kind, these were not his most serious concerns, if he himself is serious, for those lie stored in the fairest region he possesses. But if he really did set these down in writing as his serious concerns, then surely not the gods, but mortals themselves have destroyed his wits. Whoever has followed this tale and wandering account will know well that whether it was Dionysius who wrote something about the highest and first things of nature, or someone lesser or greater, he had, on my account, neither heard nor learned anything sound about what he wrote. Otherwise, he would have revered these things as I do, and would never have dared to fling them out into discord and unseemliness. He did not write it as an aid to memory. There is no danger anyone will forget it once he has grasped it with his soul, for it lies in the briefest compass of all things. But out of shameful ambition, if he wrote at all, whether claiming it as his own or as proof that he shared in a culture he did not deserve, loving the reputation that would come from the sharing. Now if this happened to Dionysius from our single meeting, it may be so. But how it happened, Zeus knows, as the Theban says. For I went through it, as I said once only, and never again afterward. Whoever cares to discover how things really went in this business must next consider why we did not go through it a second, and a third time and more often. Does Dionysius, having heard it only once, think he knows and know sufficiently, either by his own discovery or by earlier learning from others? Or does he think what was said is worthless? Or, the third possibility, that it is beyond him, too great, and that he would truly be unable to live devoting himself to wisdom and virtue? If he thinks it worthless, he will be at war with many witnesses who say the opposite, judges who would carry far more authority on such matters than Dionysius. If he thinks he discovered or learned it, and that it is worth the training of a free soul, how could he, unless he were an extraordinary person, have so casually dishonored the leader and master of these things? How he dishonored him, I shall tell. Not long after this, though before he had let Dion keep his own property and enjoy the income, he now no longer allowed Dion's trustees to send it to the Peloponnese, as though he had completely forgotten his letter. The property, he said, belonged not to Dion but to Dion's son, his own nephew, whose legal guardian he was. This was what had been done up to that point in that time. After these events, I had seen with precision Dionysius's appetite for philosophy, and I had a right to be indignant, whether I wished it or not. It was summer by then, and the ships were sailing. It seemed I ought not to be angry at Dionysius more than at myself, and those who had forced me to come a third time into the strait by Scylla, to measure once again destructive Charybdis, but to tell Dionysius that it was impossible for me to stay while Dion was being treated with such contempt. He tried to talk me out of it and begged me to stay, thinking it wouldn't look good for him if I went off in such a hurry as a messenger of these very events. When he couldn't persuade me, he said he would arrange passage for me himself. As for me, I had boarded one of the merchant ships and was planning to sail off on my own, in a rage, thinking I ought to put up with anything if I were prevented, since it was plain that I was doing no wrong but was being wronged. But when he saw that nothing would induce me to stay, he devised a scheme to keep the ships from sailing that season. He came to me the next day and made a plausible speech. "Let Dion and Dion's affairs," he said, "be put out of the way between you and me, so we stop quarreling about them so often. For your sake, I'll do the following for Dion. I'll allow him to take back his property and live in the Peloponnese, not as an exile but with the right to travel here too whenever it seems good to him, to me, and to you his friends together, provided he isn't plotting against me. You and your household and Dion's people here shall stand as guarantors of this, and he shall provide you security in return. As for the money he receives, let it be deposited in the Peloponnese or Athens with whomever you all agree on. Let Dion have the income from it, but let him not have power to withdraw it without your consent. I don't fully trust him to act justly toward me if he has free use of that money. It isn't a small sum, but I trust you and your people more. Consider whether this pleases you, and stay on these terms for this year, and in the summer go off taking this money with you. And I know well that Dion will be very grateful to you for arranging this on his behalf." Hearing this speech, I was upset, but all the same, after thinking it over, I said I would tell him the next day what I had decided about it. That was our agreement then. Afterward, left to myself, I deliberated in great turmoil. The thought that led my deliberation was this: come now, suppose Dionysius intends to do none of what he says, and once I've left, he writes to Dion in persuasive terms, urging him and many others of his own people, the very things he's now saying to me, that he himself was willing, but I was unwilling to do what he proposed, and altogether neglected Dion's affairs. And besides all this, suppose he's unwilling to send me off, giving no orders to any ship captain, and lets it be plainly seen by everyone that he doesn't want me to sail. Will anyone then be willing to take me aboard as a passenger setting out from Dionysius's own house? For I was living, among my other troubles, in the garden around the palace, from which not even the doorkeeper would have let me go without an order sent to him from Dionysius. But if I wait out the year, I'll be able to write to Dion telling him where I stand and what I'm doing. And if Dionysius does anything of what he says, my conduct won't have been altogether ridiculous, for Dion's estate, reckoned fairly, is worth no less than 100 talents perhaps. But if things turn out as they now seem likely to, I'm at a loss what I'll do with myself. Still, it's probably necessary to labor on for one more year and try to expose Dionysius's schemes by their actual results. Having decided this, the next day I told Dionysius that I had resolved to stay. But I insisted, I said, that you not treat me as having authority over Dion, but that you send along with me letters to him making clear what has now been decided, and ask whether this satisfies him, and if not, whether he wants something else and requests it, and that you write this as quickly as possible, and that you make no new moves at all concerning him in the meantime. This was said, this we agreed on, more or less as I've now told it. The ship sailed off after this, and it was no longer possible for me to sail, when Dionysius brought up the point that half of Dion's estate ought to belong to Dion and the other half to his son. He said he would sell it, and once it was sold, give half to me to take to Dion and leave the other half for the boy, since that was the most just arrangement. Struck by what he said, I thought it quite absurd to argue any further, but still, I said that we ought to wait for a letter from Dion and write him this proposal in turn. He, right after this, quite recklessly sold off the whole estate, however and to whomever he wished, and said not a word to me at all about it, and I likewise no longer discussed Dion's affairs with him at all, for I no longer thought I was accomplishing anything by it. Up to this point, then, I had been helped along by philosophy and by friends. After this, Dionysius and I went on living together, I looking outward like a bird longing to fly off somewhere, he scheming how he might shake me off without giving back anything of Dion's, but we still called ourselves friends in the eyes of all Sicily. Dionysius tried to cut the pay of the older mercenaries against his father's custom, and the soldiers, angry, gathered together in a body and refused to allow it. He tried to force the issue by shutting the gates of the Acropolis, but they made straight for the walls, raising some kind of foreign war cry. At this Dionysius, thoroughly frightened, granted everything, and even more, to the peltasts who had gathered then. A rumor soon spread that Heraclides was responsible for all this. Hearing it, Heraclides kept himself out of the way, hidden, while Dionysius sought to seize him. At a loss, he sent for Theodotes and met him in the garden. I happened to be walking in the garden at that time too, and the rest of what they said I neither know nor overheard, but what Theodotes said to Dionysius in my presence I do know and remember. Plato, he said, I am persuading Dionysius here that, if I can bring Heraclides to a meeting with us about the charges now brought against him, then, should it be decided he ought not live in Sicily, I ask that he be allowed to take his son and wife and sail off to the Peloponnese, and live there doing Dionysius no harm, drawing the income from his own property. I have sent for him before, and I will send for him again now, whether he responds to my earlier summons or to this one. And I ask and beg of Dionysius that if anyone comes upon Heraclides, whether in the countryside or here, no other harm come to him, but only that he leave the country until Dionysius decides otherwise. Do you agree to this? He said, turning to Dionysius. I agree, he said. Even if he shows up right at your own house, he'll suffer no harm beyond what's now been said. On the day after that, toward evening, Eurybius and Theodotes came to me in a remarkable state of agitation. And Theodotes said, Plato, you were there yesterday when Dionysius made those promises to me and to you about Heraclides. Of course I was, I said. Well now, he said, peltasts are running all around looking to seize Heraclides, and he's likely somewhere near here. But come with us to Dionysius by every means. So we went and came into his presence, and the two of them stood there weeping in silence, while I said, these men are afraid you're going to do something rash against Heraclides, against what you agreed to yesterday. For it seems to me he must have somehow become obviously aware that you've turned against him. Hearing this, he blazed up and went through every color a man shows in a rage. Theodotes fell before him, took his hand, wept, and begged him to do nothing of the kind. I broke in to comfort him. Take heart, Theodotes, I said. Dionysius won't dare to act otherwise than what was agreed yesterday. And he, looking at me in a thoroughly tyrannical way, said, I made no agreement with you, small or great. By the gods, I said, you did make just this agreement, not to do what this man is now begging you not to do. And having said this, I turned and walked out. After this, he hunted Heraclides, while Theodotes sent messengers urging Heraclides to flee. Dionysius sent out Tisias with peltasts in pursuit, but Heraclides, it was said, escaped into Carthaginian territory by the narrowest margin of a day. After this, the long-standing plot of Dionysius not to give back Dion's money seemed to him to have a plausible excuse for hostility toward me. And first, he sent me out of the Acropolis, finding a pretext that the women needed to hold a 10-day sacrifice in the garden where I was living. He ordered me to stay outside that whole time at Archedemus's house. While I was there, Theodotes sent for me and spoke at length, indignant and full of complaints against Dionysius over what had happened. And Dionysius, hearing that I had gone to Theodotes, made this another pretext for his quarrel with me, one akin to the earlier one, and sent someone to ask me whether I had really been meeting with Theodotes at his summons. I said, absolutely. He said, tell him then that you're doing no good at all by always valuing Dion and Dion's friends above himself. This was said, and he no longer summoned me back into the residence, as though it were now clear that I was a friend of Theodotes and Heraclides, and his enemy, and he thought I bore him no goodwill because Dion's money had all slipped away. After this, I lived outside the Acropolis among the mercenaries, and various people came to me, among them the men serving in the ranks who were from Athens, my fellow citizens, and reported that I had been slandered among the Peltastes, and that some were threatening to kill me if they caught me anywhere. So I devised the following plan for safety. I sent to Archytas and my other friends in Tarentum, telling them the situation I was in. They, on some pretext of an embassy from their city, sent a 30-oared ship and one of their own number, Lamiscus, who came and pleaded with Dionysius on my behalf, saying that I wished to leave and that he should by no means act otherwise. Dionysius agreed and sent me off with travel money, and as for Dion's money, I no longer asked for it, nor did anyone give it back. Arriving in the Peloponnese at Olympia, I found Dion attending the festival and told him what had happened. Calling Zeus to witness, he at once urged me and my household and friends to prepare to take revenge on Dionysius for having betrayed us as guests. So he put it, and so he meant it, and for having unjustly driven him out and exiled him. Hearing this, I told him to call on our friends if they wished. But as for me, I said, you, along with the others, in a way made me by force a messmate, housemate, and partner in sacred rites with Dionysius, who perhaps, on the word of many slanderers, thought I was plotting with you against him and his rule, and yet he did not kill me, but held back out of respect. So I'm no longer of an age to fight alongside almost anyone, and I belong to both of you in common, if ever you should want, out of friendship, to do each other some good. But as for evil, so long as you desire it, call on others. I said this because I had come to hate the whole wandering misadventure over Sicily. But disregarding this, and not yielding to my attempts at reconciliation, they themselves became responsible for all the troubles that have now occurred, none of which, so far as human affairs go, would ever have happened if Dionysius had given the money back to Dion, or even been fully reconciled with him. For I could easily have restrained Dion, both by will and by ability. But as it is, having rushed at each other, they have filled everything with troubles. And yet Dion held exactly the wish that I would say I myself, or any other reasonable man, ought to hold concerning his own power, his friends, and his city, to become great in influence and honor by doing good with the greatest power in the greatest affairs. But a man does not do this if he makes himself, his companions, and his city rich by plotting and gathering conspirators, while he himself is poor and not master of himself, beaten by cowardice before his own pleasures. If he then kills those who hold property, calls them his enemies, divides their wealth among his fellow conspirators and friends, and urges them to see that no one accuses him of being poor. The same holds for a man who is honored by his city for doing it this kind of good, handing out by decree what belongs to the few to the many. Or, if he stands at the head of a great city ruling many smaller ones, distributing the wealth of the smaller cities to his own city unjustly. In this way, neither Dion nor anyone else would ever willingly go after a power that brings ruin on himself and his family forever, but rather toward a constitution and a framework of the most just and best laws, one not achieved through the fewest possible deaths and murders. This is exactly what Dion was doing now, choosing to suffer unholy acts rather than commit them first, taking every precaution not to suffer them, and still he stumbled, right at the peak of overcoming his enemies, though nothing amazing happened to him. For a holy man, in matters of unholiness, prudent and sound of mind, could never be wholly deceived in his soul about such things. But it would not be amazing if he suffered the fate of a good ship's captain, one who would hardly fail to notice an ordinary storm coming, but who might fail to notice, and be overwhelmed by force before he noticed, a storm of extraordinary and unexpected magnitude. This same thing brought Dion down. He was not at all unaware that the men who ruined him were bad, but he failed to grasp just how great a height of ignorance and of general depravity and greed they had reached. And by that failure, he was brought down and now lies dead, having wrapped Sicily in boundless grief. As for what comes after what I have just said, the advice I have to give has been said, more or less, and let it stand as said. As for why I brought up my second voyage to Sicily, I thought it necessary to explain it because of how strange and unaccountable the events were. But if what I have now said appears to anyone more reasonable, and if someone thinks it gives an adequate account of what happened, then what I have said now will have been moderate and sufficient for our purposes. Plato, to the household and companions of Dion, wishing you well. I will try, as far as I am able, to go through with you the things which, if you set your mind on them, would truly bring you well-being. I hope to be giving advice that serves not only you, though it serves you most of all, but second, all the people of Syracuse, and third, even your enemies and opponents, except any of them who has committed an unholy act, for such things are incurable and can never be washed clean. Consider now what I am saying. Throughout Sicily, now that tyranny has been dissolved, the whole struggle is over this very question. Some want to take back power again, others want to put a final end to the escape from tyranny. Now the advice that generally seems right to most people in matters like this is that one should recommend whatever will do the greatest harm to enemies and the greatest good to friends. But it is in no way easy to do great harm to others without also suffering a great deal in return oneself. One need not go far to see this clearly. Just look at what has happened here, around Sicily itself, with some attempting to act and others defending themselves against those acting. These events could serve you, whenever you tell the story, as sufficient lessons for others. Of such things there is no shortage. But as for what would actually benefit everyone alike, both enemies and friends, or at least cause the least harm to both, that is neither easy to see nor, having seen it, easy to carry out. And such advice, such an undertaking in words, is more like a prayer. Let it then be entirely a prayer, for one ought always to begin and think everything from the gods, and may it be fulfilled, expressing to us some such account as this. At present, a single kinship has ruled continuously over both you and your enemies, ever since the war began, the very kinship your fathers established when they had come to the utmost extremity, at the time when the gravest danger arose for Greek Sicily of being utterly overturned and barbarized by the Carthaginians. For at that time they chose Dionysius, as a young man skilled in war, for the tasks of the war fitting to him, and as counselor and elder, Hipparinus, naming them, for the salvation of Sicily, absolute rulers, as they say, tyrants. And whether one wishes to credit this to divine fortune and a god, or to the virtue of the rulers, or to both together, along with the citizens of that time as the cause of their salvation, let it be however one supposes. Salvation, at any rate, is what came to those who lived then. Given, then, that this is how things stood, it is surely right to feel gratitude toward those who saved everyone. But if in the time since, the tyranny has misused the city's gift wrongly, for some of this it has already paid the penalty, and for some it should still pay. What penalties, then, would necessarily be just, given the present circumstances? If you were able easily to escape them, without great dangers and hardships, or they were able easily to seize back power again, then it would not even be possible to give the advice about to be given. But as things stand, both of you need to consider and recall how many times each side has come to hope that you were nearly there, lacking, so you thought, only some small thing to bring everything to pass as you wished, and how this small thing, each time, turns out to be the cause of great and countless evils, and no end is ever reached, but an old ending that seems final always joins onto a new beginning growing out of it. And by this cycle, both the whole tyrannical line and the whole democratic party risk perishing utterly. And, if things go as is likely and as one would pray against, Sicily as a whole risks becoming empty of the Greek tongue, turned over to some Phoenician or Oscan dominion and power. Against this, all Greeks must apply, with all eagerness, a remedy. If someone has something more correct and better than what I am about to say, let him bring it forward, and he will most rightly be called a friend of the Greeks. But what seems to me the case at present, I will try to set out, using complete frankness and a kind of shared, just reasoning. I am speaking, in a way, as an arbitrator addressing two parties, the man who has ruled as tyrant and the man who has been ruled by a tyrant, offering to each alike my old advice. And even now my counsel would be this: for every tyrant to flee both the name and the deed itself, and to change, if it is at all possible, into kingship. It is possible, as a wise and good man showed in practice, Lycurgus, who, seeing his own kinsmen in Argos and Messenia pass from kings into the power of tyrants, and ruin both themselves and their cities, each pair alike, and fearing for his own city and family together, brought in as a remedy the rule of the elders and the binding check of the ephors upon kingly power as a saving measure, so that for so many generations now it has been preserved with good repute, since law became master, king over men, rather than men being tyrants over laws. This same counsel of mine now urges everyone. Those who long for tyranny should turn away and flee, in utter flight, from that insatiable and mindless notion of human happiness, and should try instead to change into the form of a king, and become servant to kingly laws, thereby gaining the greatest honors from willing men and from the laws themselves. And to those who pursue free ways of life and flee the yoke of servitude as an evil, I would advise them to be on guard, lest, through some untimely insatiable hunger for freedom, they fall into the sickness of their ancestors, which those men suffered through excessive lack of rule, using an unmeasured passion for freedom. For the Sicilian Greeks before the rule of Dionysius and Hipparinus lived, as they thought, in happiness, indulging themselves, and at the same time ruling their own rulers. They even stoned to death the 10 generals who came before Dionysius, condemning them by no lawful judgment at all, so that they might be slave to no one, whether by justice or by law as master, but be free in every way entirely. And from this their tyrannies arose for them. For slavery and freedom, each carried to excess, are wholly bad, while in due measure both are wholly good. Measured servitude is service to God, unmeasured servitude is service to men. And God is law to men of sound mind, while pleasure is law to the mindless. Since this is how these things stand by nature, I urge Dion's friends to declare to all the Syracusans this advice, his and mine together, held in common. I will speak as an interpreter of what he, were he still alive and able, would say to you now. What counsel, then, one might ask, does Dion's advice reveal to us concerning the present situation? This, above all else, Syracusans, accept laws that do not appear to you to turn your minds toward money-making and wealth out of desire, but rather, since there are three things, soul, body, and, third, possessions, that make the virtue of the soul the most honored, second, the virtue of the body, placed beneath that of the soul, and third and last, the honor of wealth, in service to both body and soul. And the ordinance that brings this about would rightly stand for you as law, truly making happy those who follow it, whereas the doctrine that calls the wealthy happy is itself a wretched doctrine, a mindless notion fit for women and children, and it makes those who are persuaded by it just as wretched. That what I urge is true, you will know by experience if you put to the test what is now being said about laws, for that is the truest touchstone in all such matters. And having accepted such laws, since danger now grips Sicily, and you neither hold power sufficiently nor are held down decisively either, it would perhaps be both just and advantageous for all of you to cut a middle path, granting to those who shrink from the harshness of one man rule relief from it, and to those who still long for that rule, a share in it, whose ancestors once, and this is the greatest thing, saved the Greeks from the barbarians. So that it is even possible now to hold discourse about government at all, for had they been swept away, no word, no hope whatsoever would have remained anywhere. Let there now be, then, freedom for the one side together with kingly rule, and for the other, kingly rule accountable to law, with the laws as masters over the other citizens and over the kings themselves, should they do anything unlawful. And over and above all this, with honest and sound judgment, together with the gods, set up a king, first, my own son, in return for a twofold favor, the one from me and the one from my father. For he freed the city from barbarians in that earlier time, and I have now twice freed it from tyrants, of which you yourselves have been witnesses. Second, make king the man who bears the same name as my father, son of Dionysius, in gratitude for his present help, and for his righteous character. For he, born son of a tyrant father, willingly frees the city, thereby gaining for himself and his line honor that lasts forever, in place of a tyranny that is unjust and lasts only a day. Third, you must invite to become king of Syracuse, willingly, of a willing city, the man now commanding the enemy camp, Dionysius son of Dionysius, should he be willing to pass willingly into the form of a king, fearing the turns of fortune and taking pity on his fatherland, on the neglect of its temples and its tombs, lest through sheer contentiousness he lose everything utterly and become a source of delight to the barbarians. Having these three as kings, whether you grant them Spartan-style power or take it away by mutual agreement, establish them in some such manner as has been described to you before, but hear it again even now. If the line of Dionysius and Hipparinus is willing, for the salvation of Sicily, to put an end to the evils now present, receiving honors for themselves and their descendants both now and hereafter, then on these terms summon, as was said before, whatever envoys they are willing to accept as authorities over the reconciliation, whether drawn from here or from abroad or both, and as many as they agree to. Let these men, once arrived, first establish laws and a constitution of the sort in which it is fitting for kings to have authority over sacred matters and whatever else belongs to men who have once been benefactors. And let them appoint, as rulers over war and peace, law guardians numbering 35, together with the people and the council. Let there be different courts for different matters, but let the 35 preside over cases of death and exile. And in addition, let there be chosen judges from among those who have held office the previous year, one from each office, the man judged best and most just. And let these men judge, for the coming year, all cases involving death, imprisonment, and the removal of citizens. The king in such matters must not be allowed to act as judge, any more than a priest may involve himself in bloodshed, imprisonment, or exile. This is what I intended to bring about for you while I lived, and what I still intend now, and had I prevailed over our enemies then, with your help, had foreign furies not stood in the way, I would have established things just as I planned, and afterward, had my designs been carried into action, I would have resettled the rest of Sicily as well, taking from the barbarians the land they now hold, except for those who fought for our common freedom against the tyranny, and restoring the earlier inhabitants of the Greek regions to their ancient ancestral homes. This same course I now urge upon all of you together to consider, to carry out, and to press upon everyone else, and to regard as a common enemy anyone unwilling. Nor is this impossible. What lies within the reach of two minds, and is readily found by careful reasoning to be best, only someone lacking sense would judge impossible. I mean the two minds of Hipparinus, son of Dionysius, and of my own son. If these two come to agreement, I think all the rest of the Syracusans who care for the city will approve as well. Give honor and prayer to all the gods, and to all else that ought to be honored alongside the gods, and by persuasion and invitation, both gently and by every means, do not let friends and rivals alike hold back, until what has now been said by us, like a divine dream appearing to men awake, is brought to clear and fortunate completion. Plato to Archytas of Tarentum, greetings. Archippus and Philonides and their party have come to us, bringing the letter you gave them and reporting what you had to say. The matters concerning the city they managed without difficulty, indeed they were not especially troublesome, and they related to us what came from you, saying that you are somewhat vexed at being unable to free yourself from public business. That doing one's own work is the most pleasant thing in life, especially when one chooses to do work such as yours, is plain to nearly everyone. But you must also bear this in mind. None of us is born for himself alone. Our birth is shared in part by our country, in part by our parents, in part by our other friends, and much is also owed to the circumstances that happen to seize hold of our lives. When our country itself calls us to public service, it would perhaps be strange to refuse, for at the same time it happens that we leave the field open to inferior men who do not come to public affairs from the best motives. On these matters, then, enough has been said. As for Echecrates, we are looking after him now and will continue to do so in the future, both for your sake and for his father Phrynion's, and for the young man's own sake. Plato to Aristodorus, greetings. I hear that you are, and have always been, one of Dion's closest companions, showing the wisest character among those devoted to philosophy. For what is steadfast, trustworthy, and sound, this I say is true philosophy, while the other skills and cleverness aimed at other ends I think are rightly called mere accomplishments. Farewell, and remain in the character you now hold. Plato to Laodamas, greetings. I wrote to you before that it would make a great difference to everything you speak of if you yourself came to Athens. Since you say this is impossible, the next best thing was whether I or Socrates might come, as you proposed. But as it stands, Socrates is troubled by his strangury, and it would be unseemly for me to come there and not accomplish what you ask. As for myself, I do not have much hope that this could happen. The reasons would require another long letter to explain fully. And besides, at my age, I am no longer fit in body to wander about and face the dangers one meets by land and sea, and nowadays all journeys are full of danger. I can, however, offer advice to you and to the founders of the colony. Advice which, Hesiod says, would seem trivial coming from me to state, but is hard to grasp. If it is possible for a constitution ever to be well established by the laying down of laws, of whatever kind, without there being some authority in the city charged with overseeing the daily conduct of life, so that it remains disciplined and manly among both slaves and free, those who think otherwise are mistaken. And this can only happen if there are already men worthy of holding such authority. But if instruction is still needed, then, as I see it, you have neither anyone to teach nor anyone to be taught, and for the rest you must pray to the gods. Indeed, nearly all earlier cities were founded in just this way, and only afterward came to be governed well once, through the convergence of great events, in war and in other undertakings. A man both noble and good arose in such circumstances, possessed of great power. Before that stage is reached, you must be eager and must strive, yet you should think of things as I describe them, and not act foolishly by supposing that something can be easily accomplished. Good fortune to you. Plato to Archytas of Tarentum, greetings. The notes you sent us we received with wonderful delight, and we admired their author as much as possible. The man seemed to us worthy of those ancient forebears. For these men are said to be the Myrioi, those who were among the Trojans driven out under Laomedon, good men, as the traditional story shows. As for the notes in my keeping, about which you wrote, they are not yet in good enough shape, but such as they are I have sent them to you. On the matter of safekeeping we are of one mind, so there is no need to urge it further. This letter is disputed as not Plato's. Plato to Dionysius, tyrant of Syracuse, greetings. Let this be the opening of my letter, and at the same time, a token that it comes from me. Once when you were entertaining the young men of Locri, reclining far from me, you got up and came over to me, and in friendly spirit said something rather fine, which struck me. And the man reclining beside you, one of the handsome ones, said at the time, "No doubt, Dionysius, you gain a great deal in wisdom from Plato," and you replied, "And in many other things too, since even from the very act of sending for him, the fact that I sent for him, I gained benefit at once." This, then, must be preserved, so that the benefit we gain from one another may keep on increasing. And now, working toward just that end, I am sending you the Pythagorean treatises and the divisions, and also a man whom, as we agreed at the time, you and Archytas, if Archytas has indeed come to you, could make good use of. His name is Helicon, by birth from Cyzicus, a pupil of Eudoxus and thoroughly skilled in everything of his master's. He has also kept company with one of Isocrates' pupils and with Polyxenus, one of Bryson's associates. And what is rare besides these qualities, he is neither unpleasant to meet, nor does he seem malicious, but would rather strike one as light-hearted and good-natured. I say this with some caution, since I am giving my opinion of a human being, not a trivial creature but one prone to change, except in a very few respects and a very few people. In this case too, out of caution and some distrust, I made my own inquiries, meeting him myself and asking about him among his fellow citizens, and no one had anything bad to say of the man. Look into it yourself as well, and be careful. Best of all, if you have any leisure at all, learn from him and pursue philosophy and other matters too. If not, have someone else instructed by him, so that, learning at your leisure, you may improve and gain good repute, so that the benefit owed to me may not go to waste for you. So much then for that. As for the things you wrote asking me to send, I have had the statue of Apollo made, and Leptins is bringing it to you, a young and skilled craftsman. His name is Leochares. He had another piece in his workshop that seemed to me quite fine, so I bought it, wishing to give it to your wife, since she looked after me, both in health and in sickness, in a manner worthy of both of us. Give it to her then, unless you decide otherwise. I am also sending 12 jars of sweet wine for the children, and 2 of honey. We came too late for the storing of the dried figs, and the myrtle berries that were put away have spoiled, but we will take better care another time. Leptins will tell you about the plants. For these purposes and for certain contributions to the city, I took money from Leptins, telling him what seemed to me the most seemly and truthful account, namely that the money we spent on the Leucadian ship, some 16 minas, was rightfully ours. So I took that sum, and having taken it, I both used some myself and sent the rest on to you. Now hear how matters stand concerning money, both yours in Athens and my own. I will use your money, as I told you before, just as I use that of my other close friends, drawing on it as sparingly as I can, only for what seems to me necessary, just, or fitting, both to me and to whoever I am borrowing from. As it happens, this is my situation now. I have 4 grandnieces, daughters of the nieces who died at the time when I was not wearing the victor's crown, though you urged me to, one now of marriageable age, one 8 years old, one just past 3, and one not yet 1 year old. These I must see given in marriage, I and my close friends, to whichever of them I live to see grown. For those I do not, let them fare as they may. And whichever of them come to have fathers wealthier than I am need not be provided for by me. But as things stand now, I am the best off among them, and I also arranged the marriages of their mothers, along with others, and along with Dion. One, then, is being married to Speusippus, being his sister's daughter. For her nothing more than 30 minas is needed. That is the modest dowry we set for ourselves. And further, if my mother should die, no more than 10 minas would be needed for building her tomb. As for these matters, my own necessary expenses stand roughly as I have described for now. But if any other expense arises, private or public, on account of my coming to you, then, as I said before we must do, I will strive to keep the expense as small as possible, and whatever I cannot manage, let it be your outlay. Now I turn to what I have to say about the spending of your own money in Athens. First, if I should need to spend anything on a chorus or something of that sort, you have no foreign friend, as far as we supposed, who would provide it. And further, if anything matters greatly to you yourself, such that spent promptly it would do good, but if not spent, and instead delayed until someone comes from you, it would do harm. Besides the difficulty, such a thing would also be shameful for you. I looked into this myself, sending Erastus to Andromes the Aeginetan, from whom you told me to take whatever I might need, since he is your family friend, wanting also to send the other, larger things you had written about. He gave a reasonable and very human answer, that having previously spent money for your father he had barely gotten it back, and that now he would give a little, but no more. So I took the money from Leptins instead. And Leptins deserves praise for this, not simply because he gave it, but because he gave it readily, and in everything else concerning you, in word and deed, he was plainly devoted, showing himself a true friend. For I must report such things, and their opposite too, whatever each person shows himself to be toward you as it appears to me. On the matter of the money, then, I will speak frankly to you. That is only right, and besides, I have experience of your affairs. Those who report to you from time to time are unwilling to report what they think would count as an expense, for fear of becoming unpopular. Accustom them, then, and compel them to tell you both this and everything else. You must know everything as far as possible, and be the judge, and not shrink from knowing. This will be the best thing for you with a view to your rule, for spending rightly and repaying rightly, both in other matters and in the very acquisition of wealth, you yourself say is a good thing, and will go on saying so. So do not let those who claim to care for you set you against other people. For this brings you neither good nor honor in reputation, only the appearance of being hard to deal with. Next I will speak about Dion. On the rest I cannot yet speak until the letters come from you, as you said. But on the matters you told me not to mention to him, I neither mentioned them nor discussed them, though I tried to gauge whether he would take it hard or easily if they came about, and it seemed to me he would be considerably distressed if they did happen. In everything else concerning you, in word and in deed, Dion seems to me moderate. Let us give Cratinus, Timotheus's brother and a friend of mine, a set of light infantry armor, and to Sebes's daughters 3 linen tunics reaching to the ankles, not the expensive Amorgian kind, but the linen ones made in Sicily. You know the name Sebes well enough. He appears in the Socratic dialogues alongside Simmias, conversing with Socrates in the Discourse on the Soul, a man devoted and well-disposed to all of us. Now about the code we use for letters, both the ones I send seriously and the ones I don't, I think you remember it, but think it over anyway and pay close attention. There are many people urging me to write, and it isn't easy to turn them down openly. A god presides over the serious letter, but the lesser gods preside over the other kind. The ambassadors kept asking me to write to you, and reasonably so, everywhere they praise you and me most enthusiastically, and not least Philagros, who at the time had a weak hand. And Philides, too, arriving from the great king, spoke about you. If it wouldn't make the letter too long, I would have written down what he said, but as it is, ask Leptins about it. If you send the armor, or anything else I've asked for, send it either through someone of your own choosing, or else give it to Terilus. He's one of those who are always sailing back and forth, a good friend of ours, and a man of taste where philosophy is concerned too. He's a relative of Taso, who was the city magistrate at the time we sailed away. Farewell, and keep it philosophy, and urge the other young men to do the same, and greet the ball players for me, and give instructions to Aristocritus and the others that if any word or letter comes to you from me, they should see to it that you learn of it as quickly as possible, and remind you to attend to what's written in it. And now don't neglect to pay Leptins back the money, pay it back as soon as you can, so that others, seeing how you treat him, will be more eager to serve us as well. Iatrocles, the man freed by me along with Myronides, is now sailing with those sent from me. Find him some paid position, since he's well-disposed toward you, and if you need anything, make use of him. And keep this letter, or a copy of it, safe, and be the same man yourself.